from WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wow, what a difference a few months make. Just last March, Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich signed a law restricting collective bargaining rights for public sector unions. It was his signature law that sent a tough message to union members and their bosses. But yesterday, Ohio voters overwhelmingly rejected the law, sending Kasich a message of their own about overreaching. It was a big victory for unions and for Democrats. David Kwolke is president of the Cleveland Teachers Union.
By using their citizens' veto, Ohioans said loud and clear, we do not turn our backs on the people who have our backs.
This hour on Point, Ohio voters affirm union rights for public workers. What does it mean? You can join the conversation. What do you make of the vote in Ohio? Will it make it easier for the state to solve its financial problems or harder? And what does this say about the shifting political terrain in a crucial presidential swing state? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk about a firearms scandal that is engulfing the Obama Justice Department. But first, to Columbus, Ohio, where we're joined by Bill Cohen. He spent the past 40 years reporting on Ohio politics. He's now with the State House News Bureau. And Bill Cohen, thanks for joining us. Great to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
So what happened? I mean, this was Governor Kasich's signature issue. Did he misjudge the public mood badly, or have public attitudes shifted? Give us your take.
I think he admits that, in his words, perhaps for the voters, this was too much change too soon. This was generally a classic liberal-conservative battle here. The thing was, though, there was some crossover effect that helped the repeal forces. Democratic strongholds across Ohio went 70% for repeal. That would be expected. But interestingly, in many Republican counties, 48 or 52% of the voters went for repeal also. That showed that even some GOP voters crossed party lines to vote with the Democrats to scrap this law.
Very interesting. Let's listen, Bill Cohen, to Governor Kasich. This is him talking last night, conceding defeat after Ohio voters overwhelmingly repealed this piece of legislation.
You know, frankly, I've been involved in a lot of things, whether it's sporting activity or politics. When you get beat, you have to admit it, and you got to congratulate and shake the hands of those folks who prevailed.
So that's Governor John Kasich conceding defeat last night of his signature piece of legislation. And Bill Cohen, give us a sense, remind us first, what that law restricting collective bargaining of public sector unions would have done. And I guess we should note that it hadn't yet taken effect, but what would it have done?
Oh, it had many, many provisions, but some of the key ones, it would have outlawed strikes by government workers. It would have required all public employees to pay at least 10% of their pension costs and 15% of their health care premiums. It would have added job performance as a factor in pay and layoffs. And here's one that didn't get a lot of attention, but I think you could make a case this was probably very damaging to unions and the union side in negotiations. It would have given management the final say in long-running labor impasses. In those kind of situations, both sides would submit their last best offer, and management would decide whether to pick management or labor.
Mm. So the result, Ohio, like many states, faces financial problems. Does this give the government more or less flexibility to resolve its financial issues? Or what's the easiest way to take on that question, I guess?
Well, I guess you'd have to say it gives government less flexibility. It doesn't diminish the power of unions, so cities and schools will have a tougher time negotiating. Jason Mock, a spokesman for the Vote Yes campaign, the defenders of the law, the governor's side in this whole thing, right after the vote, he was saying, look, we're going to have more layoffs by cities and schools across Ohio, or we're going to have more cities and schools trying to have local taxes raised. And he's basically said you can lay that mess at the feet of the repeal forces because they were defending the status quo.
Give us a sense of how big this campaign was in Ohio to overturn the law. Unions, obviously, behind the effort in a big way. Ohio Democrats, you mentioned some Republicans, but also lots of out-of-state money poured in. How big was this effort?
Well, we don't know because we don't have the final campaign reports, but as of about a week before the election or 10 days before the election, the Vote No forces had reported raising $24 million to about $8 million for the defenders of the law. But again, that doesn't tell the whole story because the defenders of the law were getting help from the Republican Governors Association and some conservative groups from Virginia and elsewhere, and they didn't have to report. But a lot of that union money, still it looked like the union side was outspending the defenders of the law, and a lot of that union money wasn't just from Ohio unions, it was from national headquarters of unions, the National Education Association, the National AFL-CIO. Richard Trumka, the national leader there, came in several times to call for repeal. Jesse Jackson was here. So some national folks. So people thought it did have national implications.
Right. Now, you know, and I guess folks thought that this provided an opportunity for President Obama's supporters to test their organizational ability, possibly revive enthusiasm for the president. Any sense of how successful that was?
From the Vote, you'd have to say very successful.
Yeah.
As one, there was one veteran union lawyer who told me a few weeks ago, he said, look, before this whole thing happened, we were comatose. We were on life support. And he said, we thank Governor Kasich and his Republican allies in the legislature for overreaching and passing this law because it really has re-energized the whole union movement.
Very, very interesting. That was Bill Cohen. Bill Cohen, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bill Cohen joining us from the state capitol in Columbus, Ohio. Now to Cleveland, where we're joined by Ohioans Connie Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist and also the wife of Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. And Connie Schultz, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Hi, Anthony.
Also from Cleveland, we're joined by Kevin O'Brien. He's the deputy editorial page of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Kevin O'Brien, it's great to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, listeners, we have Connie and Kevin here. They represent opposite sides in this debate leading up to this referendum. Connie, let me come to you. You editorialized in favor of overturning this law. Give me your response to what happened out there in Ohio.
Well, I think it's a mistake to cast it merely as a union victory because there are only about 300,000 state employees who are union members who were affected by this legislation directly. And clearly, it was a much bigger vote than that, I think around 2 million to defeat it. And I think the reason for that, and I noticed this early in my writing about it, I started hearing from a lot of Republicans, which I hear from Republicans a lot, but normally not male, saying, please don't lump us with these fanatics in Columbus. And what quickly started to unfold, in my view, is that there are an awful lot of people in this state who love or respect or at least know a teacher, a firefighter, a police officer, a nurse. In my own family, I have a public school teacher sister in Ashtabula County, Ohio. I have a nurse who works in Ashtabula. And so it became very personal for entire families because they saw it as an attack on the integrity. And make no mistakes, the earlier campaign on this really went after public employees as if they had made no concessions, which was not true, has never been true. And people could smell that. I mean, it did not pass the straight face test. And I think I've said often that Governor Kasich ended up being the best community organizer in the state for Democrats.
Kevin O'Brien,
and it is true.
Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Connie, I appreciate everything you said. I want to go to Kevin O'Brien and get the quick take from you from the other side of this debate. Connie sort of characterized and Governor Kasich sort of admitted it. Big overreach on his part. Do you agree with that take or how do you assess what happened?
Well, when you count the votes, I suppose it looks like an overreach. It was, to my way of thinking, the SB 5, the bill that was repealed, was, you know, it went, it didn't go as far as it should have gone. But what's, you know, what's right and what's politically saleable may be two different things. Hmm. Connie's absolutely right about the emotional appeal of the people who were interested in repealing the bill. The entire political fight here was fought on the grounds of emotion rather than fiscal sense, and the result is what it is.
But Connie was talking about firefighters and police officers and, you know, really talking about the way they make a living. I mean, is that emotion or is that something a little more fundamental?
No, it's emotion. You look at Ohio's budget, you look at state and local budgets, you look at unions' power over those budgets. I don't think there's any question who holds the whip hand. SB 5 would have given Ohioans a chance to get out from under that. On the one hand, they chose to pat their public workers on the back, and on the other hand, they held fast to their money. If you look at how school levies did in this very election, they did very poorly. So
I want to push back on the whole.
It's a kind of a mixed message at best.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about voters in Ohio overturning a law that would have stripped public workers of the right to unionize, teachers, cops, firefighters. We're joined by Connie Schultz, Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist, and Kevin O'Brien. He's the deputy editorial page editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And Connie, you were just about to respond to Kevin O'Brien before the break. I want to go to some callers, but let me start with you.
Quickly, to suggest that this is simply a victory of emotions is so dismissive and illustrates why the SB5 side lost. This was about the right of workers to collectively bargain for wages, benefits, and job conditions, an essential right of workers. If you want to cast that as emotional, do we get emotional about the possibility of losing that? Of course. But everything, if we're going to make that argument, everything is based on emotion. This was a clear attempt to rob workers of that right. And that's what was a central issue on this on SB5.
But Connie, let me push back with just a tiny bit. I mean, in this sense, many states, Ohio included, does face all kinds of financial problems. The argument, I guess, in favor of SB5 was that the governments, local governments, need the flexibility to set their own terms, and that these union contracts don't let them.
Well, there was a moment of theater in late summer when the governor suddenly held a news conference after the bill had already been rammed through the General Assembly, and he had these empty chairs with names on them of various union members who refused to show up. Those discussions, those attempts to negotiate should have happened before this bill passed. Nobody is saying that there shouldn't be sacrifices by public workers. And in fact, public workers were never saying that. But those are the discussions that should have happened before this legislation. And I'm hopeful that they are the discussions that will happen now. And if, for example, with teachers, I hope the teachers' unions step up and figure out ways to have teachers evaluated. You know, they keep talking about merit pay and merit raises, and they should be offering criteria because they are the experts on how to evaluate teachers.
Kevin O'Brien, are you optimistic that that might happen?
Not particularly. I don't think the unions will be interested in anything along those lines. Having just one, I think that they're I don't think they ever were interested, and I think now that they have a political victory in their pocket, they're going to be less interested yet. The problem, I think, that didn't get enough exposure, and the argument that I've made all along, is that what you've got here is a structural defect that keeps the public from being in control of its finances, at the local level especially, and that's the existence of public employee unions, a fairly recent phenomenon. And to leave that in place, I think Ohioans have made it more difficult for themselves to solve their own financial problems.
Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Waterbury, Connecticut. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Speaking of Ohio bargaining rights, there's an old saying that says when the Nazis came after the Jews, I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't care. They came after the Gypsies, I wasn't a Gypsy, I didn't care. They came after trade unionists, I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't have to care. So I didn't care. So then they came after me, and there's nobody left. You know, what's to say the next step isn't, and you know, you look how the Koch brothers seem to be involved in multiple states at the same time through AFP, their front group. What's to say that they're not going to come after gas company workers next, saying, well, they're vital and all that, the rates are too high, it affects the survival of Ohio. Then the telephone company workers, and then the electric company workers. And then, well, you know, there are only two suppliers of this or that, so we can't have public bargaining in that route. I mean, believe me, this is about reducing the power of right now, the only source of, the only major source of funding to a proposed, you know, a globalist corporate America is, quite frankly, unions. And I think a lot of the trade deals that are hurting so many Ohioans now would not have happened if unions were stronger. You know, we were promised a long time ago that NAFTA wouldn't hurt workers in Ohio. And
Dave, we get the point, and I'm really grateful for your call. I just want to give time to other callers to get in this conversation and get Connie and Kevin to respond to what you said. Connie, there's Dave from Connecticut talking about, I guess Ohio, as he sees it, sort of put the brakes on this expanding anti-movement union movement. Mm-hmm. Do you see it that way?
I'm fairly optimistic about that. You know, I grew up in a union household, and I was raised to understand that when unions won benefits for their workers, they were actually elevating the working conditions for all workers. And I still believe that. And until very recently, I was a member of the Newspaper Guild, and this, which, by the way, made tremendous sacrifices and just did, again, conceded to sacrifices to keep the paper afloat and to save jobs of their fellow members. It's never been true that union members are not willing to make concessions. And when they do, when they organize and when they work to lift that tide, to use that old cliche, all boats rise.
Mm. On the other hand, here's a web comment from our website, onpointradio.org. Marcus writes, if you're a politician and turn down union demands, the media is all over you for hurting firefighters, cops, and teachers. If you cave in, there are no consequences until you turn into California. And by then, you're on your next job, or you can point the fingers at others. Standing up to unions takes a lot of courage. That's Marcus writing on onpointradio.org. Kevin O'Brien, your response to the last call.
There's a huge difference between government-based unions and private-based unions. Private unions exist to balance private interests with the private interests of a company. That's fine. If anybody wants to go after that, they're going to get some disagreement with me because I don't think there's a problem there. The problem with public employee unions is that they exist to extract money from the public. That's what unions do, and that's fine in the private sector. More power to them. But in the public sector, you've got a special interest, a private interest sitting across a negotiating table from the public and the public's interest. And, to me, that's unsustainable and unsupportable.
Let's go to Carl, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing?
Very well.
Well, I see the most shocking and stunning thing of this whole election yesterday is that more people voted against this union-killing bill than voted for the governor. And what that tells me is that the overreach from the Republican Party, Republican Tea Party, woke up a sleeping giant. And I have to tell them, and a message from the rest of us, is that there are more of us Democrats than it is for you, with your small base of white evangelical men. You can't win nationally anymore. So you have to turn to these tricks. And a message to the Republican Tea Party, don't tread on me. And we'll see you at the ballots in November 2012 and continue this shot over the bow.
Well, Carl, we appreciate the call. Let's take up that issue about the implications that this vote might have on 2012. Connie Schultz, a really basic question. What comes next for Governor Kasich in the wake of this defeat?
Well, I was encouraged by his humble speech last night when it was clear that he had lost in such large numbers. And I harbor some hope that he's going to take a step back and include everyone in negotiations and see how because our state is hurting, like every state in the union. Our state is definitely hurting. But I think your caller is correct. This was a wake-up call for both sides. Mm. And, but it wasn't just Democrats who turned out. As we know, firefighters and police, they vote for Republicans in this state, and they didn't on this issue. And the same with teachers. A good number of teachers did support Governor Kasich.
Kevin O'Brien, we heard Carl there, the last caller, talking about this being a shot across the bow and a sort of warning about 2012. Do you buy a lot of the writing that's gone on that this really this vote has a lot of significance in terms of the upcoming presidential election? Ohio, of course, a crucial swing state. What's your take on what this means about the political landscape in this important presidential swing state?
Well, at best, this election sent another mixed message because on issue two, the Democrats and they won big, obviously, but on issue three, they lost big. And issue three was the essentially the referendum on the Affordable, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which otherwise known in some circles as Obamacare.
Now, we haven't talked about that yet. Remind us what Issue 3 did. This was a largely a symbolic vote, but it expressed disapproval with some of what Obamacare stands for, particularly the individual mandate. Do I have that right?
Right. In its most basic terms, Ohio it put Ohio on the record as opposing the Obamacare system and also making it unconstitutional by the state constitution for anybody to install a Massachusetts-style state-run health care program in Ohio.
Mm. So does that suggest to you that maybe Democrats who read too much into this victory may do so at their own peril?
Well, yeah, all I can tell you is that one, Issue 3, passed by more votes than Issue 2 failed by.
Mm. What
it
do you
was,
think about
however,
yeah, go
it?
Ahead,
was vaguely, it was vaguely worded. It has no effect on the federal law, which is indeed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, not Obamacare, which is a derisive term. And it's a constitutional amendment that's going to have – which could have – the argument is now by some that it's going to have a negative effect. For example, it could prevent schools from requiring immunizations for new diseases, and it could impede state regulation of health insurers. Time will tell whether that's going to happen. My concern is it's probably going to end up in the courts, and it's going to waste a lot of taxpayer dollars because the state will defend it.
Well, it does show you where people's thoughts are.
Let's go to another caller. Deborah is calling from Salem, Mass. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Anthony. I just wanted to talk about the issue of entitlements, and I believe that it's really when you talk about collective bargaining with unions, state unions, I believe the biggest issue with regard to state budgets is entitlements. And it seems to me somewhat backwards to be attacking the unions when really we should be talking about the cost of health care, for example, and to simply try to take some rights away from union members isn't going to solve the issue of the spiraling costs, and particularly health care. And I believe that this is not a discussion that the Republicans are willing to have. And so they blame the unions. Well, you know, you can say that the unions have gone too far, and perhaps they have, but I don't really think that's the true issue. And that's really what I wanted to say.
All right, Deborah, we appreciate the call. Kevin O'Brien, let me get you to respond to Deborah's point about rather than picking on the unions, why not advocate on behalf of all working people for affordable health care, for example?
Well, I think Republicans are excited about talking about entitlements. I don't know that they would necessarily say things that I would agree with all the time, but that hasn't been a problem on that end. I think you've got more than one financial problem afoot here, and you need to work on all fronts if you've got budgetary woes to deal with. Why limit yourself to just one? Salaries of public employees are a huge government expense. Why not tackle that?
Hmm. Let's go to John, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, John.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it. What's on your mind?
Pleasure to be with you all today. Well, a few moments ago, you had a caller, Carl, who really cast this issue in a very political light. And I wanted to say, I think that he has some point in that the issue is a bit of a bellwether, or I should say the outcome in Ohio is a bit of a bellwether towards what we will see in 2012. But I don't necessarily think that what we saw in Ohio was so much about Democrats and Republicans and the Tea Party. I think it was more a situation where it is very much the knee-jerk reaction of American citizens in my 40-plus years of experience that when you say a right is going to be taken away, the knee-jerk is to say, no, don't take that.
Hmm.
So I think that was more...
So you think it was more about the sort of generic idea of a right rather than specifically about specific bargaining rights that state union workers enjoyed?
See, all of the above.
All of the above, okay. Yeah. John, Kevin O'Brien, how do you respond to John?
Well, I think he's onto something there. I don't doubt that among people who took more or less a cursory look at what was going on with the referendum, that the word right really did, you know, it did, probably did resonate with them.
Mm. Connie, well, it's called a right ahead, for a reason. Yeah. It's called a right because every worker in America should have the ability to negotiate with his coworkers. Major issues like wages, you know, and benefits. And when you look at how this campaign went, they were demonizing public workers, especially teachers. And can we just point out the hypocrisy of the right, who keeps wanting to lecture us on how valuable every human life is, every child. And yet, when they are in these schools that are dilapidating there, we want to pay teachers less than they could make in the private sector, less than they could even make, some of them working, if they work full-time as servers, if they were the hostess in a restaurant. And yet, we're expecting them to mold the minds and affect the lives of children, our most precious resource. The hypocrisy is what I think, in part, affected a lot of voters.
But Connie, let me come back to you and ask you a couple of things. We heard from Carl. John made reference to Carl's comment about this was a shot across the bow. John didn't see it as so much a Republican Democrat divide that has a huge significance for 2012. How do you see it?
Anthony, I think you answer your own question when you think about how you're in Boston and you're talking about what's going on in Ohio. Hmm. And I mean that is the greatest praise of you, because what you get is what so many understand across the country. Ohio is a bellwether state. What happens in Ohio affects the rest of the country. And in the last century, only two Democrats have won the presidency without Ohio, and no Republicans have won it without Ohio. So this is a state that everyone was watching. Certainly, the White House was paying attention to this. And I can't imagine a serious Republican candidate for president who is not having some pretty lengthy discussions today with their own campaigns about what just happened in the state of Ohio.
Kevin O'Brien, is there a danger that Democrats could almost read too much into this victory and overreach themselves in Ohio? What do you think?
Oh, yeah, probably. I mean, when did politicians who wanted something not read too much into a situation that they thought they liked? It's sort of what they do. That's why we have elections. That's why we have representative government. These things are designed to be self-correcting. So if somebody overreaches or reads too much into it, then the voters haul them back to reality at some point, and that will happen on all of these issues.
Checks and balances, elections. The story continues. It'll be interesting to follow what happens in Ohio. Connie Schultz, Kevin O'Brien, thank you both so much for helping us understand what happened out in your state. We appreciate it.
Thank you for doing the show.
Connie Schultz joined us from Cleveland, Ohio. She is a reporter. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist. Kevin O'Brien, deputy editorial page editor with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. When we come back, we'll talk with two reporters about a scandal engulfing the Justice Department over a botched anti-gun trafficking effort called Operation Fast and Furious. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. So the idea behind the ATF's Operation Fast and Furious was straightforward. Track dangerous weapons as they make their way from gun stores into the hands of criminals, maybe even into the hands of the Mexican cartels. Expose gun running networks from the inside. But things went badly wrong. Close to 2,000 guns were set loose, and they're still out there. Republicans blame Attorney General Eric Holder, who told a Senate committee this week that the aftershocks from Fast and Furious will be felt for years. You can join the conversation. What are the lessons here? What does it say about the continuing effort to control guns in the U.S.? And joining us now from Washington are two reporters who've been following this story closely. Evan Perez is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who was there in the Senate hearing room when Attorney General Holder testified yesterday. And Evan Perez, welcome to On Point. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
Also joining us from Washington is Rob Margetta. He's the editor of CQ Homeland Security, who was also at the Holder hearings yesterday. And Rob Margetta, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
Evan, let me start with you. Tell us about Operation Fast and Furious. On the face of it, it's difficult to understand what the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was doing. What were they trying to do and what happened?
Well, the idea was to try to make a big case against what they thought were going to be major traffickers. There's a constant flow of weapons, especially from the southwest border states. Arizona and Texas, in particular, are two states where there's a tradition of broad availability of firearms. And Mexico has very strict gun laws, which prohibit most citizens from buying them there legally. So, and as you know, the cartels have been at war with each other over there. So, the ATF has been trying to stem the flow without much success, in part because they say the laws are weak on their side, and so therefore they wanted to try to figure out a way to follow firearms into the hands of cartel members, and they wanted to try to go up the chain. To try to arrest and prosecute some major traffickers. The big problem here was that they didn't coordinate with the Mexican government, and they had no real way to track the firearms. They tried, some efforts to put some GPS tracking devices, but that they didn't do that too much. And in the end, they really had no way to do this that would have made sense, and that's how they lost track of them.
So, I mean, when you read deeply into this story, and Rob Margetta, let me get you to comment on this, but I was trying to catch up and really digest some of the details of this story. I mean, some of the details are astounding. You have basically ATF agents watching guns being purchased by straw purchasers and then sort of go out in the community and disappear somewhere near the border area. And these ATF agents are being told by their superiors, don't arrest them, don't detain them, let the guns go, right?
Absolutely. And you did have Justice Department officials in 2010 tell the ATF, this is an unacceptable tactic. They were looking at another operation that ran from 2006 to 2007, which also used this idea of, we watch the guns walk across the border. We then try to use evidence based on those sales to go for higher profile targets within the cartels. But the superiors within the ATF, as you said, were allowing this to happen.
Mm. And so instead, close to 2,000 of these guns are out there. Some of them have turned up at crime scenes in Mexico and the U.S., including a shootout near the Arizona-Mexican border not long ago that killed a U.S. Border agent. So that's the scene. And yesterday, Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley used his opening statement at a hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee to go after Attorney General Eric Holder and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Let's listen.
As we learn more about the utter failure to enforce our existing gun laws in Fast and Furious, I'm eager to hear from the Attorney General who he plans to hold accountable. I also want to know how he plans to prevent another tragedy like this in the future. But let me be clear. The bottom line is that it doesn't matter how many laws we pass if those responsible for enforcing them refuse to do their duty.
And here is Attorney General Eric Holder speaking at that hearing yesterday. Here's his response.
We will feel the effects for years to come as guns that were lost during this operation continue to show up at crime scenes both here and in Mexico. This should never have happened, and it must never happen again. To ensure that it will not, I took action. I asked the department's inspector general to investigate this matter, and I ordered that a directive be sent to the department's law enforcement agents and prosecutors stating that such tactics violate department policy and will not be tolerated.
Evan Perez, to what extent is Attorney General Holder on the hot seat here?
Well, he is to a certain extent. It happened on his watch, and as all these officials always say, is the buck stops with them. That said, I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around here. I mean, if you look at the previous operations under the Bush administration, there were some that were coordinated with the Mexican government, and there were some botched controlled deliveries, which is, they basically watched some guns go across, and they were supposed to pick them up on the other side and stop it, and then the Mexican government or the U.S. government screwed up, and they lost track. So there's plenty of blame to go around from both administrations. There's also, Congress is not blamed here. The ATF is an agency that's been dysfunctional for many years, and it's been basically on autopilot. They haven't had a confirmed director confirmed by the Senate since 2006. in part because Republicans and some Democrats object to ATF directors who've been nominated. The NRA has basically opposed every single one that's been nominated since 2006. So you have an agency that doesn't have any permanent leadership confirmed by the Senate, and then you have leadership that just that's just very weak all throughout.
And Rob Margetta, isn't one of the issues here as well, and something that Eric Holder was talking about yesterday, is that among the problems, scant resources and weak laws to fight it. What kind of laws would Holder want to see enacted to fight this problem of this kind of gun running?
Well, they want laws that would help them track gun sales at the southern border, which many in Congress oppose. It goes into a larger issue of agencies that operate on the southern border looking for more direction as to about how agencies coordinate and how agencies track illegal activity at the U.S.-Mexico line. There's there are big divisions in jurisdiction between ATF, FBI, agencies within the Department of Homeland Security as to who tracks what and in what case. And so there have been calls for a number of legislative changes that would iron that out. Probably most prominent has been this idea of better tracking of gun sales.
We've got a few callers lined up, so let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Cookeville, Tennessee. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how you doing, Steve?
Very well. What's on your mind?
You know, first of all, when Attorney General Eric Holder, when he testified to Daryl Issa's committee, he wasn't very forthcoming with the facts. And, I mean, the documents now prove that he knew about it way before that he said he did. And some of the whistleblowers who blew the whistle were fired. Gun dealers notified the government what was going on. They were told not to worry, we have it in control. But some of the memos show that they weren't even tracking them. In fact, it's kind of nefarious, I think, that they were going to use this to say, look at all the guns that are coming from the United States going to Mexico. We're going to have to crack down on gun sales.
But, Jerry, isn't that part of the issue? I mean, if guns are coming from the U.S. into Mexico, isn't that one of the things that needs to be cracked down on?
Yes, but it was our government allowing it to happen.
I see. Right.
Sure. That was a point that the Attorney General Holder addressed, where he was saying that, you know, Fast and Furious, it's sometimes talked about as if it created the gun running problem. He was saying, you know, the gun running problem exists. It's very serious. This was a flawed response to it. He also did address his earlier testimony, and what he said was that he had said he had known about it for weeks when he testified in May, and he essentially said that, well, it was really months. He sort of made it sound like it was a general, you know, weeks versus months, and he was also saying that's kind of a distraction, that the gun running problem is the real issue.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Let's take another one from Ryan, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. I'd like to thank the experts for coming in and shedding some light on this subject. I think it's great that you guys are elaborating, because not too many people know the details of this one. You know, I think it's a stretch for people to draw parallels to, say, Iran-Contra or other controversies involving weapons. But the interesting thing I'd like to ask you is if you think this has become partisan, if you think my Senator Chuck Grassley's efforts have become partisan, and much like we saw in the Iran-Contra scandal, that it really became a lot of showmanship between the two parties. Do you see that being a problem with this investigation?
Evan Perez, let me go to you first with that question.
Well, it's sort of like declaring whether, you know, you're shocked that there's gambling going on in this establishment. This is Washington, so of course it becomes political at some point.
It's Washington, and it's guns. I mean,
and it's guns,
you know,
right? And it's a
what's
very
more political
thing
than that? Yeah,
right. The NRA is very powerful and has used this this very effectively to highlight what it thinks is to point to politicians it doesn't believe are towing the line on the Second Amendment. So here's the deal. Yesterday, you saw some Democrats come forward and say essentially that they want to start doing their own inquiry now that it's clear that there's more to know about what happened during the Bush administration. A lot of them were silent for the last 9 months as the Republicans wanted to examine Fast and Furious. That said, I mean, I think, you know, Grassley said yesterday that he believes that, you know, he doesn't care where this goes. He wants to examine all of it. You take him at his word. And you do have a situation where, you know, obviously we have an election coming up next year, and the NRA matters in a lot of districts, a lot of conservative districts that Democrats want to try to either win or hold on to. So it has become political in a way. And also, you know, a lot of Republicans see this as a way to pay back Democrats for what they did to Alberto Gonzalez and the last controversy at the Justice Department, which was over the firing of prosecutors. So politics is very much alive in this debate.
Surprise, surprise. Let's take another call. Alan is calling from Pittsburgh. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
Regarding this Operation Fast and Furious, a couple of quick points. Eric Holder should be fired either for lying or for gross incompetence. He is the president's attorney general, and there's a lot of mud that's going to be spattered on that gentleman's trousers also. To say that nobody in the White House knew anything about this runaway operation is simply not credible.
All right, Alan. Well, let me put that to Rob Margetta. Rob, I mean, Rob, there's Alan sort of raising the issue. What, you know, what did Eric Holder know, and when did he know it? And he ought to be fired. I mean, do you see this scandal reaching that level in Washington?
You know, I don't know. That's the point that Republicans have been trying to push for months now is, you know, who knew what and when? And, mm-hmm. and a lot of that is focused on the attorney general. Now, Eric Holder basically said yesterday that he can't be expected to know the details of every law enforcement operation that's going on in the Justice Department, and that may be reasonable. There are hundreds of operations going on at any given time. Whether or not Congress buys into that idea is another matter entirely. But in terms of this taking him down, the Justice Department has essentially said, we didn't know. Until Congress started talking about this in January after the death of that border agent, we didn't know that this was an out-of-control operation. We had people in the ATF saying, this is going fine. In fact, I think one of the most interesting statements that Eric Holder made yesterday was saying that as of March, which is months into the congressional investigation, and after the Justice Department had its own inspector general looking into the matter, ATF officials were still telling him that there was no gunwalking going on, that they were not, in fact, letting guns go over the border.
Very interesting. I think we have time for one more call. Let's go to Ben, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Anthony. Yes, I think this is just part of a much bigger issue, and it's really the drug wars, since they said they stopped, but they really haven't.
The drug wars. The drug wars, you said, Ben, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
These guns are going to fuel, to use the cartels. But America's appetite for drugs is what funds the cartels.
Okay, Ben, we get the point, and our time is running out, so I'm going to jump in there and just put the question to Evan. There's been suggesting maybe a new focus here, that it's not so much about who did what and who knew when in Washington, but it's about fighting the drug wars in the wrong way. What do you think?
That is a conversation that probably should be had in this country, but it's not anywhere close to being had, and it's not. I don't see any chance of it being really had anytime soon. I mean, obviously, the government has lost some credibility with this gun operation. The Obama administration, that you know, made some moves early on to sort of signal that they weren't going to go after medicinal marijuana users, but recently they've cracked down on some of the operations in California and elsewhere. So there was a period there where people seem to be moving towards having a conversation about perhaps decriminalization and other ways of dealing with the drug trade. But I don't see that happening, especially not with an election coming up.
Not with an election coming up and not with the sort of politicization that is apparently engulfing this issue in Washington. Evan Perez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Evan Perez, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who's been writing extensively about Fast and Furious. Also, Rob Margetta, he's editor of CQ Homeland Security. Rob, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.